All right. Now, I wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to tell you today. My story will be a little bit different than George's. Natasha told me rotational mixing. I think what I decided to do is to be a little bit more general and talk about mixing in general. So my math is going to be much less. My philosophy is going to be much simpler. To me, a star is a ball of gas, a ball of plasma, where the Reynolds number is very high, so we have turbulence wherever something is moving. And so what we do is, if we consider mixing, we say we have a diffusion process. And the diffusion process, well, we solve a diffusion equation, as you've seen it on the blackboard. And the diffusion process is governed by the viscosity, or appropriate viscosity, or diffusion coefficient, which is, if we assume something like a random walk, going to be the mean free path times the velocity, typical characteristic velocity of the process. And this is of the order of a typical velocity times the square, divided by the typical time scale squared.
Sorry? The square is in the numerator.
So then what we do is we essentially consider individual processes which can move material, and we try to find the characteristic time scale of this process and the characteristic length scale of this process. And when these orders are, when these are right to the order of magnitude, we are happy. That's the simple philosophy which we follow. So you see the difference. For the angular momentum transport, we think that magnetic fields will be playing a big role in the stars. And so I come to that a little later. But just about mixing, to the danger that some of you are experts at the deeper level and will be bored, I still want to.
Don't bore me.
I still want to. Well, I'll try my best. Want to do the very basic things first. The basic mixing process in stars is convection.
Yes.
And you know that most people apply what's called the Schwarzschild criterion for convection. So if you have your adiabatic temperature gradient exceeding the true temperature gradient exceeding the adiabatic temperature gradient, convection occurs. Well, you all know that this is true only if we have no chemical composition gradients. So the stellar evolution people write this in these terms, where the nabla is the GLMT, GLNR. Sorry, GLNP. That's the true temperature gradient, but then with respect to pressure, so it's a positive thing. And this is simply a property of the equation of state. Um, So it's not a spatial gradient in the star. All right. So now some of you are bored. That's basic things. But still, I want to put this up. Because, as I said, this is true only if our chemical composition is constant. As soon as we have composition gradients, the true convection criterion is the Ledoux criterion. It writes like this: the temperature gradient has then not only to exceed the adiabatic temperature gradient, but there is an additional term which relates to the mu gradient. Now the mu is here in mu dp. Okay.
I was once told by Jim McDonald that Schwarzschild never wrote down the Schwarzschild criterion like that. That he wrote it in terms of pressure and density gradients, which is completely general. Is that correct?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's not what's written in the books. So, just to be complete, the beta is the gas pressure, ideal gas pressure over P gas plus P red. And we only talk about non-degenerate stars here, for simplicity. So, two things to be said about this. Most stellar evolution calculations use the Schwarzschild criterion, not the Ledoux criterion, for reasons which are historical, I would say, or I don't know for sure. There is no question about the fact that this is the right criterion. Yeah, so this is about the most basic mixing process we have with the stars. Sure.
In that case, of course, if we suppose that the Ledoux is correct, in between, in the portion of the star where the Schwarzschild or would say it is unstable,
I come to that.
Would say it is unstable, you will have three convections.
I come to that.
Okay, okay.
So, the second thing I would like to say about the mu gradient in general, so we have this term here, which one can show is essentially proportional to 1 over m square. And a term like this occurs in most of the diffusion coefficient, whatever instability we consider, because it's just relates to the stability of the stratification with respect to chemical gradients. So it's a very general thing. Now, you know, you all know in the sun we have ideal gas pressure dominating, so this term is one. But if you go towards higher masses in massive stars, the term gets smaller and smaller the higher the mass. And so it will be much easier to mix a massive star than the sun. Again, whatever process we consider. Okay, so why is this important? If we, for example, look at massive main sequence stars, the mu gradients, we have a receding convective core mass, so the mu gradients build up above, but not in the core, so this term really doesn't matter. Where this matters is in the case of binaries, where we have the mass gainer, because if we have an accretion, the mass grows, the convective core wants to grow in mass. And whether we apply the Schwarzschild or the Ledoux criterion makes very, very different stars in the end. And the same is true for all later burning stages. So for example, in shell hydrogen burning, we will have a convection zone above the hydrogen shell, which is in the mu gradient zone. what we apply here will affect drastically the tracks of stars in the post-main sequence evolution. Also, core helium burning for all stars. The convective core tries to grow in mass. And we get largely different yields of oxygen, for example, if we apply one or the other. Okay. Semi-convection. Yes. We can show that if we have the Schwarzschild criterion fulfilled, but the Ledoux criterion is not fulfilled, then we have semi-convection. Now, semi-convection is, sorry, convection, I think you all know the picture how to derive your instability. You move a blob and you see whether density is smaller or larger than, so you move it adiabatically. If it's smaller, it will float up on a dynamical time scale. You can do a similar picture here. You move your blob. And if you are in this situation, what your blob is doing is it will go in overstable oscillation. The growth in the amplitude is due to the fact that there is thermal diffusion from the blob to the surrounding during the process. And so the time scale at which the oscillation grows is the thermal time scale. So we have a very different time scale in both processes. Thermal time scale is much, much longer. And the thermal time scale is generally much shorter than the nuclear time scale on the main sequence. That's why for main sequence stars, you can say it doesn't matter which convection criterion you take. After the main sequence, it's very different.
No, but this is a linear instability, is that correct?
I'm sorry?
This is a linear instability. Why do we never see it in oscillation codes?
Oh, it is, has been seen. It has been seen.
In oscillation codes?
In oscillation codes. Even that, yeah, I think some Japanese people related it to non-radial oscillation.
Yeah, okay. Is it just simply that it's coupled to, if you're looking for standing wave solutions, it's coupled to other parts of the star that damp it out?
You'd have to go to high wave number, you should see it. You should just have to do high wave number.
Okay.
Because
people have to draw the connection of the simple picture to non-radial oscillations, that's for sure. And it is also shown up in hydrodynamic simulations. So,
yeah.
No doubt about the existence of this.
yeah, you should see it in your code.
But I'm wondering whether it'll be globally damped, because it couples to stuff.
Oh, maybe. That depends on.
I mean, obviously, you won't see it then, but you'll still see it in hydro.
Yeah, but if you went to a really high wave number.
What's a very high L?
Very high L, exactly. Something you may never typically do.
Yeah, right?
You
of
never
course.
Encode an L of 500, probably.
Yeah. Okay, I'll try that. Anyway, sorry.
Right, that's what you want to do.
So yeah, I'm not disputing that this exists. I was just wondering why,
Yeah, you should just do a short wavelength transverse perturbation. Okay. Just show right up.
So what we do what we do in our code is we do use the Ledoux criterion for convection. We do use the result of the linear stability analysis, derive a diffusion coefficient, and do mixing on that time scale. Now, there is some.
Just to say that on over, just to finish the thought for Rich. So this is at the local thermal time scale.
That's right.
Was what's used.
Okay.
That's right. The local thermal time scale.
That's why actually the smallest. So the largest wave numbers have the highest growth time.
It's not just local, it's a term time scale of the element. Because local can be just local for the shell.
Local is always defined as a scale height, whether you like it or not. Right,
yes. Now, we know that By the way, the mixing length theory is the appropriate local linear stability analysis for the convection. We have been seeing in the literature also nonlinear calculations for semi-convection, and unfortunately the results are grossly different from different groups, so it can be anything as a process which is really relatively fast, almost close to convection, to a process which is very slow. I like one solution which has been proposed by Hank Sprout, which works like that. If you have chemical gradient like this, and this situation is true all over the place here, then what seems to be possible to come out is basically you find a step function instead, where you have the step, you have an infinitely large mu gradient. So you basically you have hardly any chemical diffusion through this. It's only the thermal diffusion coefficient, not the atomic diffusion coefficient, which is working here. On the other hand, you have a vanishing mu gradient in between. So you have actually convection setting in there. So the effect is that you have uninhibited energy transport through convection, through the whole thing, but no chemical mixing. It's kind of the least effort approach for the star.
When you get undershooting and overshooting at those step functions?
Possible. That depends on, I'm sure, what your size is, how long you accelerate your convective eddies, and so on.
And there are going to be oscillations in that region at each interface.
Maybe. I mean, this has been seen also in numerical simulations. And if this was true, then essentially the diffusion coefficient for semi-convection would be the atomic thermal diffusion coefficient, so it's zero for the stars which we consider. But yes, there's more complications. Then, next I would like, sorry, yeah, please.
What happens when the thermal time scale becomes comparable to the nuclear time scale in the late evolutionary phases, especially the local ones, in terms of significant neutrino cooling?
I would say that then your Schwarzschild criterion tells you not the right story. Pretty sure. Then we have things like overshooting, so it's nice you push me from one to the other. It's convective overshooting. Now, again, my take on that is simple and desperate at the same time. Simple, what we do is we kind of try to rely on observations to estimate that. So first, what is convective overshooting? Well, you have a convective region in the star. Your blobs will not be decelerated until they hit the borderline. And so they will overshoot a little bit because of their inertia into the stable region. Now, if you calculate how big this amount of overshooting is for one given blob, it's negligible. It's 10 to the minus 7 of a scale height or something like that. And so one cannot simply say how big this effect is by looking at one moving blob. The question is the long-term eroding effects of these blobs knocking a little further than your convection criterion should allow them. How large is that? Now, I think that is not. This is a situation where the theoretical approach leads basically nothing. So we cannot do a local stability analysis, obviously. I believe, although some people claim they do that, also hydrodynamic simulations have a very hard time to assess this because we need to look at the long-term effect over many, many convective cycles, at least over a thermal timescale of the star, to get the thermal feedback from the restructuring of the star.
So when you say that the precursor is for chemical composition or for the energy transport?
Both. I think it's both. Of course, you know, the thermal effect is at first glance not so large for the star, because once you mix material out, of course, that will stay. Thermal effect is going to be limited. It changes your radius a little bit or whatever. What the thermal effect can do, however, is to push your convective boundary deeper in. That's what I've seen happening in my models. And you know, then the whole problem changes. You know, the zero point is moving. So I think it's theoretically not accessible at the moment. And what people do is, of course, they look in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. How wide is the main sequence? Because if we apply overshooting, bigger main sequences, and that is a little bit intertwined with how much rotational mixing we have, so it's also difficult. And so far, this has been really successfully done, I would say, mostly at low masses, below 5 solar masses or so. If you go to higher masses, we don't have really star clusters well populated where we can see that. There's some ideas that maybe main sequence comes at really high mass stars goes very wide, which you know could be related to this effect, but it's all pretty much volatile and in the air. So I think that's three things which are really important and open since I started working on stars. No, since longer. This might be. And perhaps more important even than rotational mixing, at least all this is relevant for non-rotating stars. So that's why I thought I want to mention it, not that rotational mixing is not important. Okay. Then I have would briefly mention magnetic fields as well. And magnetic fields, as I said, may be very important for angular momentum transport. And when people talk about magnetic fields, I see many, many misunderstandings, because magnetic fields can mean different things to different people. So, for example, we have magnetic stars. Yeah. So, the magnetic main sequence stars, which I assume you all know. So, we have a star. And what we see is something like not really a dipole field, but a large scale field looking like this. Now, it's theoretical evidence which says that probably this field configuration must first of all continue in the interior of the star, and second, you probably need a toroidal field component to make the whole thing stable. Otherwise, the magnetic tension would just make your field disappear on a short time scale. So, that means if we see a kilo Gauss field at the surface of a star or the magnetosphere inside the star, the field is probably stronger, maybe much stronger. Actually, there's a theoretical argument saying that from John Braithwaite and Hank Sprout's analysis that the toroidal field can be 1,000 times stronger than the poloidal field. And so in that situation, I think the star will have to rotate rigidly. I cannot see how this, how such a configuration can be maintained over a long time when we have differential rotation. Then in the non-magnetic stars, 90% maybe of the main sequence stars, we have perhaps still the Brown-Taylor mechanism working. I know it's disputed, but the idea per se is starting out at least very simple. You have any kind of seed field, and if your star is rotating differentially, then it's going to be wound up. And so you will have a predominantly toroidal field. Now, just a toroidal field would not be stable. It would decay again. So it has to be continuously reformed. And so that means you will get into some kind of equilibrium between differential rotation and magnetic field generation. So it, with completely rigid rotation, this cannot work. If one goes through the numbers, then one finds the rotation which results here, at least for main sequence stars, is still close to rigid rotation. So these fields are toroidal, and they cannot look like this. Yeah? So we won't see much of them, if at all. There may be instabilities involved in the magnetic field saturation, which also involves some chemical mixing. I don't want to go into that because I'm really not sure I understand that very well. But it's not per se clear whether magnetic fields are only responsible for transporting angular momenta. It could also be that they lead to some mixing of chemical elements as well. Just for completeness, there's also the local magnetic fields. Which we get from convection, for example. If we have a convection, maybe there's a dynamo. Also when the convection zone is rotating, and then we get flux tubes, which lead to flux concentration, and we get like a magnetic sunspots. And you know that Matteo has worked on that and will tell us, I think, during the conference that also massive stars have these things. So it's another type of magnetic field which probably doesn't play a role for what we're mostly interested in here. Yeah, so...
Does that work in radiative zones?
Yes. All it needs is differential rotation. If you can I put a picture? If you have, say, the surface rotating faster than, sorry, slower than your core, and you imagine your magnetic field line is a spaghetti which is anchored at the core and at the surface, then you just wind it up. Okay, that's more or less all I have for you, actually. So I didn't talk much about rotation. Well, George has covered that very nicely in his way. Maybe I should tell that also for the rotational mixing processes, as I said, we have a diffusion process, and we find ways to derive these two quantities, and then we hope we get the time scale of the mixing right.
So you said at the start you'd be happy if you got the order of magnitude right. Do you think you get the order of magnitude right?
Now, how do we know that? we've been busy the last 20 years almost to try to find observational tests of these kind of mixing processes. So one of the most important triggers in the study of mixing from differential rotation, mixing and rotating stars, was the discovery that many stars on the main sequence, many massive stars on the main sequence, are enriched in nitrogen. And so also we were triggered by that. And what turns out to be the case is that we have a degenerate situation in that, yes, our models for rotating stars can reproduce that. We can obtain some nitrogen from the convective core and transport it to the surface. And that happens, of course, the easier in the more rapidly rotating stars. But then the binaries do it as well. And the binaries do it by mass transfer. So one doesn't need any rotational mixing process. But what the binaries also provide is a spin-up mechanism of the accretor. So you see the nitrogen there, but where the stars are rotating fast. So it's the same prediction. And even with large samples of stars, we've tried to disentangle the two effects. And so far, it's very difficult to do.
We go to stars in the mass range that Rich was talking about yesterday for the SPD stars, where, I mean, I would hope at some point we could, let's say, I mean, there's a reasonably well phenomenologically motivated overshoot for the low-mass stars, you know, 2 or 4.
Yes.
Right, which, I don't know, if Rich didn't really say it explicitly, but one would assume for the astroseismology for those, that should be a testable, that should be part of the exercise of the astroseismology.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Confirming or denying what is being used to get the right turn off.
So, there are...
Yes, but was it done or not?
People have played around with overshoot in the, 2006, 2007, the models done to see whether you could get the turnoff, or not the TAMs, see how it varies with overshoot, and then compare that against SPB stars. Because you know SPB stars have to be main sequence objects, so you've got a pretty good idea. And I think the conclusion was that some sort of modest overshoot is required to explain the observations.
I recall there are several papers in the literature which try to deduce convective overshooting from oscillation data, in fact. But I think the answer isn't really homogeneous. You find some which say that it's close to zero, and some which really predict one which is bigger than what we would expect based on the typical widening of the main sequence.
It seems to me that we had a discussion with Rick Dowd yesterday that actually, astroseismology can give you the size of the core. But I was wondering whether it can give you the process which give...
Yeah, I mean, the mixing length, you know, overshoot is just a parameterization of our ignorance. And so, George is quite right that really when we're diagnosing overshoot, we're diagnosing an enlarged core, really.
Maybe there's one thing then I would like to point out about the rotational mixing. To me, the key about any mixing is really, you know, the mu gradient term. So how, well, mixing naturally involves mu gradients. It's actually not always true. Like we get in our models most of the nitrogen enrichment at the surface of main sequence stars from mixing out nitrogen very, very early during cohydrogen burning, when there is actually essentially no mean molecular weight gradient yet. And
because the core is larger at the very beginning?
No, that's not the main effect. The main effect is that you burn your carbon to nitrogen before you burn any hydrogen to helium, really. And the nitrogen is just a trace element, which so the chemical... the mu gradient term is still very, very small. So you're not inhibited by this. So let me just finish my thought, which is very brief. So it's important how this is treated also in the rotational mixing processes. In our models, we use a parameter with which we can tune this mu gradient term up or down. And what we prefer to do in the end is have this parameter such that this mu gradient term plays still a significant role, such that in the end, for example, we do not have much mixing of helium out of the convective core into the radiative envelope. And if I compare to, for example, George models, that's different. What I see is that in your models, there is a lot more mixing of helium into the envelope of the star. So, like concerning the overshooting, our convective core mass is not very much affected by whether we switch on rotational mixing or not. In your case, I think this is different. So, and this all relates to how the mu barrier is actually considered.
Can I ask? So, on final, we have three actual talks on the chemical uniform fast rotating stars. Can I ask you? Because you're
on Friday.
On Friday, yes. Okay. With three contributing talks which are devoted to this.
Okay.
So, which main mechanism, because all of them have roots in your core, so which main mixing mechanism is for that, and what's the main uncertainty?
Yes, sure. In our models, what we do is we employ this Sprout-Taylor mechanism for angular momentum transport, and one of the consequences is, as I said, that the differential rotation is becoming quite small. And as a consequence of that, the shear mixing doesn't play a major role in these models. And so the major mechanism which does transport chemical elements concerning rotational mixing will be the Eddington Sweet circulation.
Is that not suppressed by the magnetic fields? In these very strong field stars, you would expect that.
There is no real circulation anyway. As I said, we have a turbulent plasma, so no single atom is going to follow nicely the meridional current pathway. That doesn't happen at all. Also, what George said is true, that horizontal instabilities are much stronger, which will basically thread apart all these nice trajectories. But the shear instability depends on the gradient of the angular velocity. The Eddington Sweet mechanism does just depend on the angular velocity itself. So at least we don't need shear, we don't need differential rotation to trigger that. What the magnetic field in the end does with that, how these all these instabilities interact, we don't know.
But spirit level is must, right? So it's a base condition, so you have to have parallel magnetic field inside. You say that here plus spirit level instability.
I'm not sure what you mean by it must. It's a must. I mean, it's, in the end, it depends on what mechanism you think really works
but
in nature.
That's what I asked, what's the name? So
if you say there is no magnetic field in your stars at all, then this will not work.
Okay.
So it's an assumption which you put in.
But it's a dynamo, it generates it, right? As long as you have an arbitrarily small field to start,
and
you always will. And
yeah.
The idea of Sprout-Taylor is that it amplifies the field.
I think that probably the Sprout-Taylor is not, I don't think people question the existence of the seed field. I think what is questioned is the how to close the dynamo loop, and that's a separate question. But I think that if you believe the fact that, plasma and star are easily magnetized locally, then you can easily...
I'm not questioning that, just
yeah.
Asking what is...
Yeah,
sure.
No final answers from me,
sorry. Yeah. Actually, we have also the Sprout-Taylor mechanism in our computer, so we can also do computation with this nearly solid body rotation. Actually, if we would be God, we could make a very interesting, I would say, experiment with stars to say whether angular momentum is transported by meridional currents or by I would say magnetic fields, not Laugrenian momentum, it's not caused by magnetic field, and it would be solid-bodied, or if there is differential rotation. Actually, if you have, let us say, 9 solar mass stars, and you make it to rotate fast initially, and then by any mechanism, either by the presence of a companion or by a wind which is coupled with the magnetic field, you break down the stars. In case most of the mixing is driven by shear, there will be two things which will occur. The stars will slowly rotate because it is breaking down, but the shear will increase the mixing. So you will have slowly rotating stars with high nitrogen enrichment. If you now start from a solid body which is imposed by, for instance, a magnetic field, if you slow down the star, you reduce the mechanism of the mixing mechanism of the chemical species, and you will have a slowly rotating star which is not enriched. Would you agree with that?
I don't understand how you slow it down in your first experiment. I didn't.
Actually, if you take, for instance, stars which is losing mass at high rates with the wind, and you suppose that there is, for instance, a strong surface field, which will couple the wind to the surface, in which case you will slow down stars by wind magnetic braking as a sun.
If you have a surface field, I think the field will.
Oh, I see.
In that case,
it would be incompatible with the fact that there is no magnetic field inside. Okay. But let us take then the companion, for instance. You can also slow down the stars.
Tiling,
I would say, in that case.
Sure.
In that case, if you have shear mixing for the chemical species, you will increase the surface nitrogen enrichment. If you have mixing by meridional currents, you will increase the surface nitrogen enrichment. So it may be a way, I don't know,
to look at that.
Maybe it's a good idea.
Dissipation.
Thank you very much.
Sure.